Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. A year ago, Israel was a house divided against itself. The streets were full of protesters against Prime Minister Netanyahu's efforts to change the judicial system and other policies. Roughly one-third of Israel's reported very strong conflicts between left and right, as well as between religious and secular Jews. And almost half of Israelis reported very strong conflicts between Israeli Arabs and Jews. Then came the Hamas attacks on October 7 and the subsequent ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. Both have been catastrophic for Palestinians, for Israelis, for the region. And of course, that story isn't over. But it seems to me like the right time to try to explore how the past year has affected ordinary people, their daily lives, their hopes, and their fears for the future. Today's podcast is the first in what I hope will be a series of conversations with Israelis and with Palestinians, not necessarily about big picture politics or strategy or the war per se, but about the human impact and implications of all the hatred and fighting and destruction of the past 10 months. Joining me today are Liora Hadar and Natty Barak. Liora lives in a West Bank settlement and is a mother, a bibliotherapist, and an activist in the grassroots peace movement, Women Wage Peace. Natty is a retired businessman, sustainability expert, farmer, and a longtime resident of Kibbutz Hatzerim in the Negev Desert. Welcome to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm happy to be here with you.
Frankly, I can't imagine a situation in this fraught world that doesn't need more new thinking than the Middle East in general, and maybe Israel in particular. Let's start with a personal question. How are your lives different today than a year ago? Liora?
I think for me personally, and for, I guess, almost any citizen in Israel, things are not the same. Everything's changed. I think people used to have this belief that we're safe here in Israel, all in all. And we have the Israeli army to protect us. And we have our government, who, even if we don't agree with it, okay, when right-wingers are against the left-wing government or left-wingers are against the right-wing government, but still you have like a basic trust, very basic faith that you're protected here in our independent state of Israel. And I think October 7th was a huge blow. And for many people, Israel is a small country, as you probably know very well. And so, for example, also personally myself, and also almost all my friends, family I know, the community I live in, everyone knows someone who was either kidnapped or murdered or injured. Okay, there's almost no one in Israel who doesn't have a connection or relation, because the numbers of the numbers on October 7th were so high. And Israel is a small country and everyone's kind of connected in a way. So the feeling was that we all know people and it hit so close to home. I think people before October 7th had more faith in the possibility, I think, of coexistence here in Israel. And for many people, that kind of crashed and was broken. And I feel it's going to be very hard, very difficult to rebuild the trust, the basic trust. And a lot of people today who say even stronger that we need the hope, we need we need to rebuild the trust, we need to rebuild the faith even more than before October 7th, because this, what happened, just goes to show what happens when for so many years you neglect basically, you know, political horizon, and for many years just military force was, you know, the main path. So for many people, some people say, this, from this big crisis, also a new opportunity can arise. We have to explore and see what are the new opportunities that can arise from such a terrible disaster.
I want to pull on several of those threads in a moment, but Natty, first, today versus a year ago. How is your life different?
Well, things have changed. You know, we are in the midst of, I don't know what's the strongest word, but we're in the midst of a disaster. And, you know, one of the labor movement leaders many years ago wrote an article which, you know, the title was Strengths for a Change Before Disaster. And now we must be strong to make some change after this disaster. We are in the midst of this disaster and we have to recognize it. And for me, again, a year ago, I wasn't very confident with the tension within the Israeli society. We went outside to the streets to protest against the changes, you know, political, social, legal changes the country underwent. And but for many things, things were very clear to me. Look, I've been living in an agricultural community almost all my life, you know, since I was 20 years old, so last 60 years. I'm in this kibbutz, and things were so clear to me. And after October 7th, I lost my confidence in so many things. I mean, Israel is my home. I was born into the creation of the state. I consider myself part of shaping the state of Israel economically, socially, even, you know, security-wise. I felt very confident in my way. And now I really don't know. I'm still optimistic. I still follow the same ideals and ideas that led me throughout the years. But I must say that I'm confused.
Again, a number of threads I want to pull on, but I want to go back to the period before October 7th. Israel seemed to be coming apart at the seams. Not just the protesters, all of the indices, all the measures of democracy, all the polls about the future and hope, they were flashing bright yellow, if not even flashing red. Why was that? What were the forces? Was it just Bibi, who's an extraordinary politician? Whatever else you think about him, here's someone who's been prime minister for, what, 17 of the last 24, 25 years. It's extraordinary in a democracy. He keeps on getting himself reelected somehow. So maybe it's just Bibi, but my guess is more fundamental things are going on in Israel, were going on in Israel before October 7th, that produced that sense that the country was coming apart. Am I right? Am I wrong? Is it just Bibi or is it fundamental to the society?
I would say fundamental to the society.
I knew you were going to pick that door, so tell me now.
Yes, you're right, that before October 7th, it was maybe the worst time that I remember that Israel was so split down the middle socially. And like you mentioned, the judicial reform was it's not just Bibi. It's other people in Bibi's Bibi's coalition, as you know, that were pushing to this reform. And of course, Bibi was allowing it and maybe pushing for it himself. I don't know. But there were other names that were pushing towards the judicial reform. And the judicial reform was, for many, many people in Israel, was a big red flag that was saying, no, this is, we have to put a stop to this reform because it's going way too fast. And it's basically going to turn Israel into something that's not a democracy. And people were very scared, because they saw a similar process happening in Hungary and in Poland over the past 5-10 years. And there was a real fear that this is, that there was a real fear. People are afraid the baby was actually is going towards some kind of dictatorship one way or another, and kind of hiding it, you know, masquerading it. But that's secretly his direction. And people really were afraid that Israel's not going to be a democracy anymore. And like Nati said, he was part of, Nati's part of the people who went out to demonstrate and say, it's not going to happen, not on my shift. And for many people, the other half of Israel is saying the judicial reform has to happen. It has to happen because, now I'm not going to go into the reasons, but it's the right thing, that there has to be some sort of judicial reform, because the Court of Justice, the High Court of Justice has all the power. And also not in a balanced way. And personally, like in many, for me, in many areas of my life, I sort of have a tendency to see how where there's truth in every side of the conflict, and how I can see how both sides are right in a way. Okay, and both sides have a case. And a lot of times that's what happens to me in many like areas in life, including the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and including the internal Israeli conflict. I come from a very different history, personal history, and than Nati. So I grew up in a religious Jewish family in Haifa and also in the United States. And today I live in a settlement in the West Bank that we are religious and secular, living here together in our settlement. And I'm also involved in many peace peace-building NGOs and organizations and movements. And I think part of the reason that I find myself in these areas is because I really tend to see where there's truth, where there's like an essence of truth in either side of the conflict. I try to kind of like mediate in a way, and I find myself bringing one voice into the space, into a different space, and then a different voice back to the other space, and trying to. So yeah, it was scary before October 7th. And a lot of people realize that one of the reasons the attack happened October 7th was because our external enemies saw that Israel is being torn apart from the inside. And this was like the right opportunity to attack, as we've seen in Jewish history times before.
So after October 7th and the war that continues as we're speaking, do you still think those conversations can bridge the conversations you're trying to stimulate can bridge this gap?
I think it's going to be more difficult than before. I can say from personal experience that over the past 10 months, more or less since October 7th, different movements, okay, and different initiatives that are Israeli-Palestinian or as Jewish as Arab and such, and maybe Nati has a similar experience. A lot of these, like, you know, Peace Now and Women Wage Peace and Roots and Combats for Peace, a lot of these NGOs, there was really a difficulty after October 7th to continue the dialogue. And a lot of these NGOs took a pause of a few weeks to a few months even, and slowly are now coming back to dialogue, coming back to meetings. But yeah, there's a feeling that you have to kind of rebuild it again, not from scratch, but yeah, you have to rebuild because something broke. Something was really broken on October 7th. And I think people don't want to lose faith, but you don't want to lose faith. But on the other hand, you can't pretend that nothing happened, you know?
Eddie, what's the mood on the kibbutz?
You know, we are busy. You know, the kibbutz in a way was established to solve national tasks. So just, you know, a small story. One of the kibbutzim that was hit, well, you can't say hardest on October 7th, but became kind of a symbol, is Kibbutz Be'eri. Kibbutz Be'eri is the same size as my kibbutz, Chatzerim, was established on the same night on October 1946. And a relatively successful kibbutz. 100 members were massacred, were butchered on the kibbutz. And they are coming to leave. We decided they were evacuated to a hotel next to the Dead Sea. And we decided in Kibbutz Hatzerim to build a temporary kibbutz for them. So we are busy doing things. We are busy offering solutions to this specific challenge. So this is our mood, and we are busy. We are keeping busy with that. And then, of course, many of our young members are on reserve duty in the military. So we feel it in some of the branches of the kibbutz. So we are, but again, you know, I myself spend most of my time in a group which is relatively very homogeneous. You know, people around my age or a little bit younger, people that took part in shaping, and people that are not afraid to use the words values, ideology, liberal. And most of my friends went and participated in the demonstrations. And again, we didn't call it the judiciary reform. We called it the judiciary revolution because of the way that is conducted. And again, you know, I'm not against. I think that reform is always something positive and should take place. But after, I was always very optimistic and thought that the only solution for the Israelis and for the Palestinians is to have what we call the two-state solution, to have a Palestinian state and to have, of course, the state of Israel. And you asked about Bibi. I think that Bibi is master of orchestrating masses. And because of his personal challenges, the legal case and so on, he kind of moved a focus from taking care of Israel and our future to taking care of Bibi Netanyahu and his future. And this is terrible. It was terrible when he led the judicial revolution. And it is terrible when he is doing it, running the war now. So I'm still optimistic. I still think that peace will come. But I must admit that my confidence is a little bit shaky now. And not only because what's happening in Israel, but also the terrible things that we saw on October 7th. I mean, I used to work in Gaza. I used to sell drip irrigation to farmers in Gaza. And farmers are farmers all over the world, and I enjoyed very much working there. This was many, many years ago. And I felt that the people there, we can make peace with them. And always said, you know, half jokingly, that the problem is politics and governments and so on. But among people, we can have peace. After October 7th, I kind of lost some of my confidence, but I still think that that's the only thing that we can do is try to achieve peace and the two-state solution. I'm afraid that it will take longer now.
I used the word catastrophic in the introduction, talking about the impact, talking about what happened on October 7th, but also what's happened since October 7th in Gaza. It has been catastrophic in terms of human life, in terms of buildings, in terms of futures. Lots of things have been crushed in Gaza. As Israelis, how do you guys think about that? Someone want to volunteer to go first?
Okay. You know, I think it's terrible. Again, I know the Israeli military, and I know most of the people, but again, in a way, the Israeli military is the Israeli people. I know how much we are doing to avoid hurting uninvolved people. I know missions that have been pulled back because the suspicion that some uninvolved civilians will be hurt. I know, again, you know, we have this phrase that the Israeli military is the most moral military in the world. And I think, you know, the people that are fighting there are my friends. They are people with values, and I'm sure that most of them are doing everything in their ability to avoid hurting uninvolved civilians. But this is a war, and this is a war that started on October 7th. What we saw, you know, butchering people, burning people, butchering babies, you know, being proud. You know, there was this picture with media today. You can't take some pictures. You know, seeing a young Palestinian in one of the kibbutzim talking on the phone to his mother and bragging, being proud of how many Jews he killed. You know, Golda Meir said once that she will never forgive the Arab leaders for forcing our people or our youngsters to kill during the war. Again, Israel, what we did, I was involved a little bit, not enough, and with a movement which is called On the Road to Recovery, where volunteers from my kibbutz and all over Israel drove Palestinians from Gaza, sick children, old people, mainly cancer, to hospitals in Israel. And they had contacts with people in Gaza. One of the activists was Vivian Silver, a beautiful lady. And she was murdered, and some of those volunteers were murdered, and they tried to call their friends in Gaza, and they didn't answer. So I think you want to take revenge after something like this, and you're trying to stop yourself because you know that revenge can lead to terrible things. The bottom line, you know, my answer, I'm so sorry about what's happening in Gaza. I cannot be proud of what's happening in Gaza. But in very plain, simple, you know, they started something terrible. You know, you cannot imagine the massacre in Kibbutz Be'eri is something like 18 miles from my home. Gaza is 20 miles from my home, and my place is considered safe, relatively. Okay, so we spent 2 days, the first 2 days in a sheltered room, but we are considered in the center of the Negev. It's close to here. It happened close to here, and I wish we can reach an agreement now and stop the war and start negotiations, and with the help of the United States and some the more stable Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and so on, get back on the road for peace and agreement. I'm afraid that it will take longer now.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on TelbergFoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Leora, you spend a chunk of your time and have spent a chunk of your life working for peace, trying to work across not just internal Israeli lines, but with the Palestinians, et cetera. Given what's happened, not only on October 7th, as you both eloquently have talked about, but since October 7th, how do you even phrase the question? Is peace possible? Will people forget? Natty used the word revenge. When I talk to some of my Palestinian and Arab friends, I hear the same word, but they're talking about the future. At the start, you said, I hope there's opportunity here somewhere. But how do you find opportunity after a catastrophe, perhaps, but in a catastrophe, in this human catastrophe?
First of all, we're still in it. Many Israelis feel that we're completely still in the catastrophe. We're not after the catastrophe for many different reasons. First of all, all the kidnapped people that are in Gaza, the hostages are still there, and they're not back home yet. And we have Hezbollah in the north and the whole threat from Lebanon, backed by Iran, of course. And so everything is still happening. We're in the midst. I just wanted to add to a couple of things also that Nati said. So I think, first of all, I want to say that, first of all, my heart does go out to any babies and children and women that are suffering. I think that just because I feel that after October 7th, I felt that Israel had no choice but to respond to an attack like this, it doesn't make me happy to see the pictures coming afterwards from Gaza and the uninvolved people that sometimes get hurt, sometimes are killed, sometimes are injured. I know Palestinians who have families in Gaza, who lost family in Gaza, friends of Palestinians I know here in the West Bank. And it's hard. It's hard on everyone. I do remind myself that, like Nati said, this basically the minute Hamas invoked this horrible, horrible massacre. So when I see pictures from Gaza, I remind myself that Hamas is who brought upon this terrible catastrophe on Gaza. And one of the reasons that Hamas, I hope, will in the end not be in charge of Gaza and will be replaced by something more moderate is really not just for Israel, but also for the people in Gaza, because they're being controlled by Hamas, which is horrible for them as well. And I think that people to people on the ground, grassroots movement, are a wonderful thing. I think when I meet Palestinians on the ground, neighbors of mine or people I know, not in the high politics, people want, a lot of times you meet people and they want to live a peaceful, quiet life. They want to, raise their children. In Gaza, over the past 18, 20 years, Hamas has been in charge. And since that day when Israel pulled out of Gaza and more or less 6 months later, Hamas was elected. And since then, Hamas has been ruling. I feel that less and less people in Gaza are so-called neutral, because the moment children who were then 5 years old and are now 25, okay, in 2024, were raised the past 20 years in kindergartens and schools and summer camps of Hamas, then you don't even talk about uninvolved, or you talk about, just people, that people to people we can connect. I feel like when Nati said, yes, it could be that 30 years ago, that was the situation. But I feel like the whole generation that grew up in Gaza in the past 20 years have grown up under Hamas and under Hamas education. And this is our biggest, for me, this is one of our biggest tragedies, is that we allowed this to happen, like right outside, right on our fence. In the south, just like Nati said, very close to where Nati lives and the other kibbutzim. And just beyond the fence, this was what happened over the past 20 years, all so much hatred of the existence of the state of Israel. So going back to the idea of the two-state solution, I think a lot of people today in Israel have partly lost faith in this idea of a two-state solution, because they realize that Hamas and Islamic Jihad, as we all know, they are not opposed to the fact that Israel is controlling the West Bank. And Hamas is not the kind of party that would say, oh, if you just let us have a Palestinian state alongside with you, then we'll live in peace side by side. No, Hamas once the complete destruction of the state of Israel, and only then it will rest, okay, backed by Iran, etc. So this is, for me, like a lot of people, I don't know if a two-state solution is even possible. I don't know if it's smart. I don't know if it's strategical. I do feel that the opportunities that do arise have to do with a new regional alliance, a new regional security alliance that will allow basically a pact between moderate countries. And if Israel can create this regional it's not Israel and the Palestinians. It's not Israel versus Hamas. This is an illusion. It's on a much larger scale. It's a regional conflict and maybe even a world war. So there's, you know, Iran and Russia and China, and there's Israel, United States, certain European countries, moderate Arab countries that Nati mentioned before. If we can create a strong alliance of moderate countries who want to live in peace and oppose Hezbollah, Iran, Hamas, and I think only in that way we can and try to also create a new, maybe kind of Palestinian authority that is willing for peace, as opposed to Hamas and Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah. If we have a new Palestinian authority that is willing to live in peace with Israel, then we can work towards a regional, you know, better future for the region. But yes, it's very difficult. And I'll just say, because Nati mentioned Golda Meir and something she once said, so I'll say something else that Golda Meir, I think it was Golda Meir that said that if the Arabs will put down their guns, there will be peace. But if the Jews put down their guns, there won't be Israel. And that is basically what we've been dealing with the past 75, 80, 100 years here in this area of Israel. And that's basically the feeling of many, many people in Israel today, I think. We don't like to fight. We don't like to have the military. We don't like the fact that we all have to go to war. My husband is in the army. My sister, her husband is in reserve. My sister's son is joining the army now and is actually going to have to go fight. We're not happy about it. We're not excited about it, but we really don't have any other choice. And this is how we're feeling.
Let me switch gears slightly, but it's related. I've seen reports that something on the order of 500,000 Israelis have emigrated over the last year, in a process that continues, and that there are fewer, not surprisingly during a war period, coming into the country. There's a sense, certainly outside Israel, that something fundamental has changed in Israel for the worst, not just during the last 10 months, but before then. What's Israel's future like 5 years from now? 10 years from now?
Alan, it's a tough question. I think I have to be optimistic. The way that I see Israel is, and again, you know, I'm busy. I've my business, you're familiar with it. You are helping farmers all over the world to grow more with less. Israel is the startup nation. Israel is liberal. Israel is sending aid to many countries all over the world. We have the best medical services. We have culture. We have, in essence, society which is very open, very liberal. I keep repeating this word. And when you ask this question, I stop for a minute and I look, and there is something. I hope, you know, I see Leora, which is, I don't meet Leora's friends. I'm not religious. My wife doesn't dress like Leora. And I don't live in a settlement in the West Bank. And when I see Leora and I listen to her, it encourages me that we can live together. But sometimes I feel, you know, it's like being on a roller coaster, and I'm too old for riding roller coasters. And sometimes when I see some of the extreme right leaders and I listen to them, I say to myself, no, I don't want my children. I will not immigrate at my age, but I want my grandchildren to live in Israel, in this country that, you know, as I said, I was part of building it. And there is a trend in some countries in Europe, even some places in the United States, and that I don't like. I want Israel to be liberal. But if the extremists from the right will take over, I don't see my children staying here. I don't want to end, you know, I am optimistic. I think there's something in us. We are, you know, I spent some time in the United States in the 70s. The kibbutz, the idea of the kibbutz was popular. Israel was popular. People listen to us. You know, in recent years, with the SDGs and the environment and so on, Israel has so much to offer. And I'm afraid that we may lose it if we do not unite under a more liberal and open leadership.
Vera, let me tweak the question slightly. Mm-hmm. I heard a talk recently by Yossi Klein Halevi, a Jewish American author I'm sure you both know, who said he fears that the startup nation has become the survival nation. I'll ask you, would you agree or disagree? Is Israel in danger of becoming not the startup nation, but the survival nation?
Well, I can say that it's interesting because when you phrased it like that, I just remembered, I recall, I think the application Waze is an Israeli invention. Which you probably
it gets me lost all the time. I've got to tell you, I have
really
have to complain.
Israel worked very well until October 7th, I think it's kind of like symbolic that it's an Israeli invention. It's an amazing application, and over the past, you know, 6-8 months, in the whole north of Israel, there we cannot use the Waze because we have to the GPS there cannot be accurate because of the missiles from Hezbollah from the north. So once you hit a certain point, if you're driving north in Israel from a certain area, suddenly Waze evaporates, it disappears, and it says that you're in Beirut actually, and you're not in Beirut. You're in the northern part of Israel. But even Haifa, where my parents live, there's been no Waze for the past few months, and people had to go back to original maps, how we used to navigate once before there was Waze and Google Maps and all that. So in a way, when you asked that question, I kind of thought about it a little bit in that symbolic in a way. I do see that, like Nati said, we're going through a very rough period. And I have friends personally that I know who left Israel and moved to live in the United States or in Europe. Also before October 7th, during the half a year before October 7th. And I think mostly before October 7th, I saw people who were leaving Israel and immigrating. But I must say that I know also of quite a few people who are coming back to live in Israel after October 7th. And I just want to say that on October 7th and on October 8th and October 9th, the number of Israelis who were coming back, who were traveling abroad, who are on a, you know, who are taking their tour in the Far East or in South America, you know, after the army, a lot of young people between the ages of 23 and 28 who are traveling, who are in the middle of doing their studies and went abroad to travel. So many, almost everyone was coming back into Israel after October 7th. And there were all these jokes, you know, on the social media. A lot of these jokes were saying, any normal country, when a war starts, people people are escaping out of the country. And Israel is the only country where a war begins and everyone's trying to get back in. And the flights were full and people, Israelis were in the airport saying, I have to get back to Israel. I have to get back to Israel. I have to get to my unit. I have to get back to my family. And it was a crazy situation, how many people were trying to come back. And not only that, but also during the days after October 7th and during the weeks after October 7th, I don't ever remember in all the years I'm alive and that I can recall such an unbelievable, what's the word? And everyone tries to come together and try to help in any way they can, okay? From emotional therapy, military, you know, things that were missing for the army, food for soldiers, any kind of equipment that soldiers need, from underwear and towels and shampoo and everything that was being shipped to where the soldiers are, families that were evacuated, like Nati said, from kibbutzim, that were put in hotels. So many people are displaced now. Thousands and thousands and thousands of Israelis are living in other places and cannot live in their home. And the unbelievable, the volunteering that was going on in the first, the number of WhatsApp groups that was open, even just to do laundry for families who were evacuated from their homes, and people who didn't even know these families were taking their clothes into their homes and doing laundry for them and bringing it back to their hotel or to wherever they were staying. It was unfathomable. I couldn't even understand how so many people can do so much good for complete strangers. And it was such a hard time, but also it was so moving. It was so moving to see the volunteering spirit of the Jewish people or of the Israeli people during these months. And for me, it was a big wow, really wow. I think for a specific number of months, yes, we're in survival. And it makes sense, I think, after an attack like October 7th, which Israel, from when Israel was founded, I don't think we went through something like October 7th ever. And I think that it makes sense that, first of all, you're in a survival mode. But the question is, where do we move from here? And I want to be optimistic, just like Nati. And I want my children I want my children to live in Israel. Of course, for me, it's also scary. Do I want them to grow up here? Where do I want them to grow up? I myself grew up also in Israel, but also in the United States and Canada some of the years. So I kind of, you know, grew up with two mother tongues and in two cultures and two countries. And I kind of can compare as well and see. And I don't have like a solid answer. But just like Nati, I'm very, very connected to this land, to this people, to our history, to our culture, to the Hebrew language, to everything that makes us, you know, unique. And I want to hope that even if we're now in a survival mode for a certain period, after terrible catastrophes, there is also a spurt of like growth. And I'm hoping that's going to happen here as well.
Let's leave the conversation there only because I have dozens and dozens and dozens of questions, and that would take dozens of hours. Again, thank you for spending time with us today. Yes, Nati.
I want to add something, if you don't mind. Again, you can cut it. But
I promise I won't cut it.
No, I really don't know. But Liora, listening to you, I was, for some reason, in 1973, I lived with two small children near Washington, D.C. And then October War, Yom Kippur War, and I tried to get on the first airplane that I could. And I got to the war and to the Golan Heights. And then after a long time that I didn't get any mail, I was in a unit of paratroopers on Mount Hermon, and we got letters from home. So all the Israeli children drew pictures of airplanes and rifles and bombs and so on. And my daughter Naama, who was in a kindergarten in the United States, sent me pictures of smileys and flowers and nice colors. And the moral of the story is that basically we are in a war. What happened in October 7th we are using the same terminology or vocabulary that we use when we talk about the Holocaust. In a way, we never experienced something like this. But still, I think that our future is entangled, is connected to the future of the Palestinians and the futures of the Israeli Arabs. And I think that we have to change leadership, both there and here. Because you said, and it's true, the years of educating Palestinian kids to hate us, it will not take one day to change it. But many kids in Israel also, and now they have all the reason in the world not to like the Palestinians. There's hatred, and there's not always the right education. And I think that the only way we have to end this one war that we have since 48 until October 7th. We have to end the war and find a way to live in peace.
There's nothing that either of us can add to that.
Yeah.
Either as a question or as a comment. So thank you, Nadi, very much. Thank you, Liora, very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.